Occupied Territory with Mike Fader, Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Occupied Territory, and I'm Mike Fader. Welcome to the, I think it's the third or maybe the fourth edition of this show, which is fairly new. And we're following the Occupy movement all over the country. Whatever form it takes, we're going to shape ourselves to it. And because I believe, as I've mentioned before, that this is our last chance. I do believe that this is our last chance. Been around for a while now, longer than I even maybe have wanted to, many, many, many decades. Lived through the 60s, and I have not seen anything like this in 40 years. And with the increasing government intrusion on our lives, the technology they have, the militarization of the police, I don't believe we're going to have one more chance. This has to be sustained. Now, a lot of these places are being, a lot of the Occupy encampments and occupations are being evicted. They're being moved peacefully, and in many cases not peacefully, as we've all seen. But we'll see, and winter is coming, so we'll see what form it takes in the next couple of months. But spring is soon to be here. And I think what a lot of people want to do now is a big discussion in the movement. If you don't maintain the occupations, then you don't have the visibility. That's the way it works. If you're inside in an office or you're making even daily or many times a day forays to occupy, let's say, bank buildings or to go to Senate hearings or to jam the streets or to appear in any place, that all counts for something. But unless you're actually there occupying public, in some cases private, space on a regular basis, then you lose a lot of the in-your-face, this is what's really going on power, the visibility of it. So it's a real problem. But now, today, I think what we're going to do is, in future shows, we're going to focus on student debt. We're going to focus on all sorts of different things, constitutional rights. But today we're going to focus on the police response to the Occupy movement. And when we talk about the police response, of course, we're talking about the government response. And then, of course, we're talking about the 1% response, because who owns and controls the government? The rich and the powerful. So when one cop in any place picks up his baton and smacks somebody over the head with it, it's the same as if the Koch brothers or Bloomberg hit them over the head. That's the way things work. So we're going to discuss that today. Before we do that, I wanted to mention the call number here. The call-in number for listeners is 888-874-4888. Okay, 888-874-4888. Tweets, comments, and questions at PRN_radio, at PRN_radio. And if you want to get to the, I have a Facebook page for this, Occupied Territory has a Facebook page. And I really want everybody to come on there and comment. I post articles on it. The shows are posted. Please put your questions down there, your comments, any links, videos. And the way you get there is just go to the archive page on PRN. Go to PRN, find the archive page for Occupied Territory, and it will tell you how to get to the Facebook page. We are going to have a guest on. I don't know if we're in touch with him yet, but we're going to have a guest on in just a few moments who is a former chief of police in Seattle. In fact, he was the chief of police in Seattle. His name is Norm Stamper. During the 1999 protests and demonstrations against the World Trade Organization, which did turn violent, and there was a lot of police overreaction. So there's a man who knows what this is all about, who was on the other side of it at the time. And all of us have seen a million times, and we don't even want to see anymore, the video that was on YouTube. And that's been shown on TV, a million times now, of Lieutenant John Pike, formerly, I hope I can say that soon in an official way, of the UC Davis campus police, pepper spraying people. And we've seen people in Seattle, an old woman in Seattle, get sprayed in the face with pepper spray. There was video when they evicted people from Zuccotti Park a while back, where a woman was holding up the temporary restraining order granted by a Supreme Court judge, She was holding it up and shouting at a cop. She leaned over the barrier where he was. The order permitted everybody, by the way, to go back into Zuccotti Park, but the police weren't let. They defied it and didn't let anybody back. She leaned over and kept yelling at this cop, and she just pushed it sort of at him. She didn't touch him with it. And he leans over, big guy, punches her right in the face. This is not some quote-unquote dirty hippie or out-of-control lunatic or whatever. This is a woman dressed like an upper-middle-class-looking woman with dyed blonde hair, with a fancy haircut, and she's got a raincoat on. And she's just holding up a temporary restraining order from the state Supreme Court judge. He punched her in the face. And you saw what happened in Berkeley with people ramming billy clubs, that's what we used to call them, batons, sticks into people's stomachs. Ribs were fractured in Seattle, in Denver, which I know a lot about because I've been in contact with people there in depth. One person was hit with a motorcycle and was unconscious, and the police didn't let any medics near him. What on earth is going on? The press put in chokeholds, people thrown to the ground, pepper sprayed when they're already barricaded behind plastic netting. What has caused this? Why are they acting this way? And what could be done about it, if anything? So we have with us Norm Stamper. Hiya.
Hi.
Let me introduce you to people so they know who they're listening to.
Sure.
Norm Stamper was a police officer for 34 years. He served as chief of the Seattle Police Department from 1994 to 2000. And as police chief in Seattle, he led a process of major organizational restructuring, creating new bureaus of professional responsibility, community policing, family and youth protection. And Mr. Stamper was a member of the National Advisory Council on the Violence Against Women Act, Police Executive Research Forum, International Association of Chiefs of Police, and Major Cities Chief. He is the author of a book called Breaking Rank, a Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. That's more about drugs and the effect on the cops?
Well, that's one chapter, but it's a major one. Uh-huh. I'm convinced that the drug war has done more than anything else to strain the relationship, if you will, between community and police, and particularly among young people and poor people and people of color. But there are 29 other chapters that deal with, among other things, the WTO riots in 1999.
And I guess comments and speculation by you on that, right? So this book was published in by Nation Books in 2005. Still in print, is it?
It's still in print. It went they're both hard copy and paperbacks available.
Okay, Breaking Rank, a Top Cop's Exposé on the Dark Side of American Policing. That's Norm Stamper. I just want to mention you're also a member of LEAP. That's Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Maybe you could talk about that touch before we go ahead.
We believe some 40,000 of us now. Most of the early literature talks about a 10,000 member organization, but we now have upwards of 40,000 people who are current and former police officers, correctional officers, prosecutors, DEA, FBI, Homeland Security agents, judges, including a couple of sitting judges, and prison wardens. And we are all united in our belief that the drug war has caused more harm than good, that it is time to end it. It is time to recognize that prohibition, which is sort of the organizing mechanism of U.S. drug policy, is a failed public policy. It failed in the 1920s with alcohol, and mm-hmm. it's been failing over the last 40 years or more with all other drugs.
Well, you'd put a lot of prison officials and correction guards out of work, right, wouldn't you?
Well, I think we need to ask ourselves, even with jobs becoming more and more scarce and people experiencing major economic problems, how much the drug war is contributing to our economic malaise. Mm-hmm. The Great Recession is in large part attributable to Wall Street and to mortgages and subprimes and other kinds of stuff that many of us have a fairly superficial knowledge of. But we also need to recognize that we've spent $1 trillion prosecuting the drug wars mm-hmm. in 1971, and we pump another $69 to $70 billion down the rat hole every year, and that's money that could be spent on jobs.
And keeping all these people locked up and feeding them and housing them and clothing them when they shouldn't be in jail in the first place, right?
It's enormously expensive. And, of course, one of the trends that we have seen is the privatization of prisons, mm-hmm. so that you have corporations who are literally making money on a per diem basis. They build a cell, they fill the cell, and they make money by doing that.
So they would be happy to keep all the drug laws. It benefits the corporation, right?
Oh, they would add to them, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But it's wrong. I mean, it's morally wrong. It's really unconscionable to think that any piece of the criminal justice system is now profit-motivated.
So this show is about the Occupy movement that's breaking out across the country here and has broken out. I wanted to talk about that, and I want to talk obviously about the police response, and clearly you're an expert, but let me get this out of the way before we start. You were the police chief during the World Trade Organization protests in 1999 in Seattle, right?
I was.
And you were in charge of the response to the protesters, the demonstrators. They weren't all so nonviolent, but generally you were in charge. And later on, I'm looking at some quote here from you. It says, the chief and me should have said, for the greater good, we ought not to have brought those chemical agents out. We ought not to have, I think, raised the stakes. And you see what is going on in New York City, Berkeley, Denver, University of California, Davis, and other places like that. We're talking about punching people, choke holds, after they're already, encircled by that orange netting, pepper spraying people for no reason at all. Then you saw what happened with Lieutenant Pike the other day, you know, at UC Davis, which is extraordinary. Tear gas canister fired directly at people, people unconscious, people hit by motorcycles, people with fractured ribs. And then, of course, same thing, restraining the press, arresting the press. What is going on? What has happened to the police? Is this something that we should have always expected? Is there something new going on here?
I don't think it's new. I think the institution itself comes from a very tainted history. Policing and police agencies have basically been exploited and used for political purposes throughout the history of the country.
Mm-hmm.
We have, and I'll consider myself still part of that institution, we have been aligned with, landlords over tenants and management over labor, and the list goes on and on.
I mean, you go all the way back to the 19th century with this.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, and particularly in Philadelphia and New York, which are our first two big police departments.
Mm-hmm.
But much more modern history, in the last 20 years, we have seen increased militarization of American law enforcement. Part of that I've already alluded to, and that's the drug war. We have law enforcement agencies across the country, some of them in tiny rural communities, who are fielding SWAT units and largely because they've been given money or equipment or weaponry by the federal government in support of homeland security. So I think those two factors, the drug war, homeland security, have added to what was already basically a paramilitary structure and a paramilitary culture.
So
that hints at war. It hints at missions. It hints at police pitted against their own people.
Well, I guess let's try to approach this maybe a little bit from the devil's advocate point of view. I mean, if you look at the drug wars and you look at the cartels and you look at armed, drug dealers in cities like Philadelphia, Baltimore, New York, you name the place, right? Meth dealers out in the Midwest and places. These people have increasingly more high-tech weapons. You know what I mean? They have machine guns, AK-47s. They've got this. They've got that. They've got body armor. They've got rounds that are really dangerous. I mean, do the police need tanks and observation towers? And I mean, and as far as security goes, I mean, I talked to a guy last week on the air. He's in Nashville, and they got all busted up by the cops out there. And they have a Tennessee Department of Homeland Security. There seems like there's some sort of excuse here. Are people being carried away by what they see to be as patriotism, or is this an excuse to sort of militarize and control the whole country?
I think it's a combination of both of those two factors, and I would add another. As soon as you introduce tools that oftentimes are perceived as the toys of the trade, people need to play with them. And that's why, for example, monies targeted for Homeland Security, and I question that as well, I think, as you do, but monies dedicated to Homeland Security have completely been co-opted and converted into weaponry and arm. You know, we have armored personnel carriers and so forth in some communities that would just shock you. And it's a function, I think, of a major distortion of the threats to the country, both internal and external. But nobody who saw those images or who suffered losses in the 9/11 attacks is going to argue against Homeland Security. But we have a right and an obligation as Americans to argue against abuses carried out in the name of Homeland Security.
Well, speaking
and
of
excesses carried out.
Well, 9/11 was an attack, you know, by people from a foreign country against one-time isolated targets in certain places. But what's happening now clearly is a preparation for what appears to be homegrown terrorist invasion forces, like insurgents, as if America was Iraq or Afghanistan. And I guess once again, we have to go back to something you referred to earlier, is a lot of these weapons and weapon systems and consultants involved with them add up to a lot of money, right?
They add up to a huge sum of money, and money speaks in this country, and it's very, very clear that there are people with vested interests in making sure that the drug war continues and making sure that the abuses and the excesses of Homeland Security go unassaulted or unassailed. So we're seeing a chipping away, in my view, of our civil liberties. We're seeing a fundamental change in the tone and tenor of American law enforcement. I mentioned that it's always been paramilitary.
Mm-hmm.
But lately, it's gotten, in my opinion, much, much worse. And I would say this, for example, looking at the Occupy movement, there are political players who need to be implicated in this process. They're, in many cases, either tacitly or implicitly, or in some cases, explicitly saying things that make it very clear, for example, that there will be no encampments anywhere in the California college and university system.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you send that word out to the campuses, and cops are made to understand that they're to follow orders. You get situations like the Pike situation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my opinion, that's probably the most iconic and certainly one of the most egregious abuses of force that I've seen in a long time. Particularly given the circumstances and his casual nature of spraying young, nonviolent, non-threatening demonstrators around whom they could have walked if they needed to get to the other side.
Well, the worst of what happened is that since they were already told that they were to move and that they were there illegally, they were told that, then what would happen after that is what's happened a thousand times in this country, is that the police would have to do something that would probably maybe result in a few pulled muscles, but they'd have to pick them up and bring them to wherever it is they wanted to bring them. But the spray was to render them completely unable to resist. I mean, what are they afraid of, the police, is if these kids clearly aren't going to attack anybody? I mean, I don't get what's going on here.
Certainly didn't get any sense of physical fear on the part of Pike,
right,
or any of his other cops, for that matter. These kids were absolutely non-threatening, and they were engaged in a rich tradition of civil disobedience. Of course they had been told to move, and let's assume for the moment that it was a lawful order. Then you come down to the tool, the rule of the tool. If all you've got is a hammer, then the whole world's a nail. So you're looking at a police officer with a big canister of orange pepper spray, and he uses it. He should have, if he was ordered to use it, and there's no evidence that he was, but if he had been ordered to use it, he should have refused that order. If not unlawful, it was certainly immoral. And it produced these unconscionable results. I mean, we're now focused on the police.
Mm-hmm.
in many parts of the country when we should, in my view, it would be wonderful if we could remain focused on Wall Street greed and corporate greed.
That's why these Occupy people are out there. I mean, that is their message.
I don't know a single cop who is a member of the 1%.
Well, of course not. And, you know, it was interesting. The other night I was watching TV, and they had a detective on from Madison, Wisconsin police force. And I think he was the head of the union out there. And they had this gigantic occupation back. Remember in January, February in the Capitol at Madison?
Because of course.
They were going to take everybody's pension away. And
sure.
It was astounding what they were going to steal from people, mostly state employees. And the cops showed up off duty to protest, right? There wasn't a whiff of pepper spray. There was not a baton raised. There was no violence there at all. And it was interesting to see that this detective, I forget his name, they all understood, because they were being attacked by the legislature and the governor, they understood that they were part of, let's use a certain phrase, the 99%, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the police, you know, obviously far more than I'll ever know about this, but the police have a certain kind of mentality, which is a sort of hierarchical male, you know, mentality. It's a military organization, as you pointed out, and there are certain psychological elements get involved in that. Also, if you get a direct order, you're supposed to follow it unless it's clearly immoral. So, and also, a cop doesn't make very much money. I mean, talk about, you know, the 99%, and they can hardly support their own families on the humiliating pay they get in most places. So, with all that, Garrett, why is it that it's so hard to get them to understand that at least they shouldn't beat up on people? I don't get
it. They come from a very, very deep and very tenacious workplace culture that has been shaped over decades and certainly is not likely to change by Tuesday of next week. But during the 90s, for example, we were moving toward something resembling authentic partnerships with our communities. We were moving toward what I would define as a true version of community policing. We were a long ways away from the ideal, but at least we were recognizing that the issues of public health and public safety are best served when the police are a part of and not apart from the community.
Mm-hmm.
Don't mean to turn this into a speech.
That's all right.
But what I'm saying is we had a pretty good and healthy trend underway. Then we had 9/11 against the backdrop of the drug war. And I think what that's served to accomplish really is greater and greater distance between the police and the community. It's much easier to hit somebody, spray somebody, engage in an abusive act if you don't know them, if you have no relationship with them.
Right.
And so I've tried to tell a number of people that we're in the moment and we'll always be of the moment, and we're looking at events and we'll never be able to avoid that, and we always should be looking at events to hold individuals accountable. But for God's sakes, we have got to draw back and take a look at the systemic implications of this police behavior and begin to do something that would actually forge relationships, positive relationships, which at least present an opportunity for some mutual trust.
Well, maybe they could take this interview with the police in Madison. Maybe somebody could put together a training film of what went on in Madison, Wisconsin, and make it required viewing.
Well, let me tell you what I heard about that. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
I heard from some police officers in San Diego and in Seattle who said, you know, labor is trying to get us to join them and participate in these protests.
Right.
Can you imagine that was their response?
Can you imagine that? Who are they? Who are they?
That we would join the great unwashed. That we would put ourselves within the ranks of protesters in something other than an undercover capacity.
Well, now
I'm thinking, my God, what, do you realize what you're saying?
Well, now we're wandering straight into Freudian territory here, right?
We certainly are.
You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
I mean, if you're talking about a change over the last decade or so or more, if you see, now I don't want to be too simplistic about this, but, you know, tell me what you think. I mean, you've got the president of the country, Now, when I was brought up, this is a while back, and we studied all about in school, George Washington, the father of our country, you know, the president is often viewed, and even if people don't realize this or admit it consciously, as the father of the country. People in leadership positions, if you go even from a family unit straight to a community to the presidency, they are examples of what a leader should do. They are the father. One day maybe it'll be the mother, you know. But when you invade countries illegally and immorally, when you blow people up by operating a console outside of Las Vegas on a military base, but they happen to be 12,000 miles away and you blow up a bunch of kids, when there's the disconnection, when you see examples being set by people that are illegal, that are violent, and that are immoral, I think it filters down to the whole society.
I'm absolutely convinced that it does. And of course, there was some of this in World War II, but it really emerged in Vietnam, that those involved in bombing targets were not simply involving or rather attacking a military target. They were attacking people, human beings just like them. And many people suffered greatly from that experience. And I just couldn't agree more. When we make of all of our work, for example, some kind of a mission, moreover, a military mission, that means that the people on the other side are the enemy.
Well, combined with this disconnectedness, with this anomie that we have here, I interviewed a major of an air wing unit who went to work every day as a 9-to-5 job at a military base outside of Las Vegas. And he basically was playing video games. Only real people were being blown up 12,000 miles away. I mean, you can't operate a world like that.
No, you can't. It's truly frightening. I mean, if we stop and think about the implications, that we can detach ourselves so deeply, profoundly from other human beings who have more likely than not the same life concerns that we do.
Well, the other part too, though, then, if you look up at the leaders, for instance, you were the police chief in Seattle, right?
I was.
And so people would look to you for literally for orders, but then also for what attitude and what leadership qualities and what behavior should be displayed. So I don't want to put you on a hot spot, but there you were giving the orders, providing the leadership and perhaps the attitude. And this is what goes on, right?
Well, it is true, and I certainly gave the worst order of my career on the second day of the World Trade Organization battle in Seattle, using chemical agents, in this case tear gas, against nonviolent, non-threatening demonstrators who, as we have discussed, would not follow our direction. Mm-hmm. We gave them a lawful order to clear an intersection that we believed absolutely needed to be clear. I could go into those reasons. But for 5 years after my retirement, I believed that I was right. I knew the decision would be unpopular. I knew that it would radicalize, certain numbers of the tens of thousands of demonstrators we had on the streets of Seattle then. But I believed that it was the right thing to do. And it took listening to an awful lot of people who were there in a different capacity from law enforcement while I was on book tour. And coming to my own realization that was the cop in me who had agreed with the decision, and it should have been the chief in me who vetoed it. But I did not, and I will live with that regret for the rest of my life.
Well, there's probably nobody better than you to advise other policemen and other police departments, don't do that. Right. I mean,
and of course, I've said it in any number of venues and interviews and in some of my writing. And it's clear that some people did learn the lesson of the battle in Seattle. But it's also painfully clear that many did not.
We have, if you just tuned in here, we're talking to Norm Stamper, and that's Stamper, PhD, I should add. He's a police officer for over 30 years and was formerly the chief of police in Seattle. Two questions before we have to go to a break here. If you were Mayor Bloomberg, how would you have dealt with Zuccotti Park? I mean, I was down there. There was a couple of, the usual portion, if you know New York at all, of lunatics and drunks. You know, there was a few of them in the park, but they were fringe elements literally on the edge. There was one or two little crimes that were reported to the police. It was. I'm fastidious, and I even in the 60s I wasn't sleeping outside, so I'm that kind of type. You know what I mean? But
okay.
But when I went down there, I mean, yeah. So everybody was coughing, and they were serving peanut butter out of open cans, you know, and things like that. So, but meanwhile, they're down there for a much more important reason. What would you? So he used the excuse of being a nuisance and being unsanitary. But what would you have done with those people? I mean, after all, they are there for a reason which far exceeds minor local ordinances. What would you have done if you were Mayor Bloomberg with those people?
Well, let me tell you that I was at I live on an island off of Washington State, but I was in New York and visited Zuccotti Park. Unfortunately, it was at a time when there was a large contingent of demonstrators who had gone to Brooklyn and another who had gone to Harlem. So what I saw mostly was homeless people and vendors and a few many expressions of political messages.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just, and I promise you an answer to this.
That's all right.
Let me provide a little background. I think what happens is you get people like Bloomberg or virtually any other mayor who's a thoughtful person, who says, I surely do understand the anger. I surely do understand the pain that people are in these days as a result of our economy and these abuses, the corruption, the greed, so on and so forth. So I support you. I support your purpose. I support your agenda. And by the way, here's a public park. We'd prefer that you not block intersections. We'd really prefer that you not block a bridge. But that would be coming from the highest political levels of a city, in this case, Bloomberg. He did that. He essentially said that. And I knew as surely as I was standing there that it could not and would not last, that the real enemies of the tactics, not necessarily the goals, but the tactics of the Occupy movement are business owners looking forward to a Christmas shopping season. They are residents who may be living in $1.2 million condos high up above Zuccotti Park.
Mm-hmm.
And they are enormously bothered by the disruption of their business, the loss of their profits,
the noise
that keeps them awake during mm-hmm. the middle of the night. And they're powerful people, and they exert pressure on these political figures.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's happened whether it's a college or university campus or a city like Philadelphia, L.A., Seattle, Newark.
Mm-hmm.
So it's inevitable that you're going to get the plea to shut it down. At least clear it out, clean it up, then let people come back, but not camp, and subject them to reasonable measures that would control for noise and the like. Free speech is, in fact, an abstraction, but when you start applying concrete law and Supreme Court cases and so forth, you find that the manner and the methods by which free speech is exercised can be regulated. And most cities 10 and 20 and 30 years ago enacted no camping overnight in park ordinances. And they did that largely as a result of drunken parties or drug dealing or sexual assaults. And that stuff was real.
I understand that. I mean, I've lived in New York City all my life. I'm glad.
Well,
And
so, you know, if you're Bloomberg, you're between a rock and a hard place. You believe in the movement.
We should just postpone that conversation.
Okay. I thought it was quite ironic and funny as he attempted to rub elbows with the people that he was told he was one of the 1% and wasn't welcome there.
Well, when they came near his house, he actually basically closed down one of the busiest streets on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, which is outside of his. I mean, he closed it down. You couldn't even get on. You couldn't, as a citizen of New York, you couldn't even walk down that street. I mean, basically, he leased a street with an option to buy. You know what I mean? That's what he did. But let's get off that for a second. One last question, because we do have to take a break, and there's never enough time to really get into these things, obviously. But the people who assembled in Boston Common in 1770,
mm-hmm.
They were probably told by the governor and the soldiers outside that they weren't allowed, that it's against the law to form a large crowd, right, mm-hmm. in Boston Common. You know what? This is a democracy, and my attitude about it is, now I'm sort of being rhetorical here, no pain, no gain. So there's local ordinances, there's nuisances, and then there's an entire theft of an entire country by a bunch of rich people. So, you know, I mean, up to you. Over to you.
We are on the same sheet of music completely. Where we may differ, and I don't know that this is true because we haven't really talked
right.
about it, but where we may differ is on the tactics used by Occupy. I firmly believe that that the mass movement, the visible presence, these encampments have had a huge and positive effect in organizing and mobilizing people and, in effect, creating new rules for communication through social media, a variety of other things. I think the question facing the Occupy movement now is, how do we reach out to a larger and larger and larger base within that 99%? And I think it's important that accepting the fact that the movement is essentially leaderless, that some thought be given to creating a really cogent set of tactics that will actually change the country. Yesterday in Olympia, our state capital here in Washington, and the day before, there was an occupation of the rotunda at the State House. And then yesterday it turned a little nasty, and there was a whole lot of screaming and profanities and threats and so on and so forth, and the legislature called an end to the action.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not a whole lot different from what was happening in 1770 in Boston Commons.
Not much, no.
So the question is, from there, where do we move?
No, that is the question, and I guess we could disagree or even discuss this further, but unfortunately, I do have another guest coming on.
It's presumptuous of me to talk about what the Occupy movement should do. It's not presumptuous of me to say the police must be absolutely neutral. They need to be neutral if they're policing an Operation Rescue, anti-abortion protest, or an Occupy protest.
Mm-hmm.
And where they do what they have done in too many cities already, they forfeited their neutrality. And I think it's just really awful.
Yeah, well, I can only but agree. Well, I appreciate your coming on today, and maybe what we'll do is talk again, somewhere down the line, see how things have changed.
I would look forward to it.
Okay, that's Norm Stamper, you just heard, who was a former police chief of Seattle, and we're going to take a quick break. This is Mike Fader. The name of the show is Occupied Territory, and we have a telephone number here for listeners if you want to call in, 888-874-4888, and tweets are at PRN_radio. We'll take a break, and then we're going to talk to another guest who is a reporter who is based in Denver who witnessed a police attack that happened in Denver. Okay, Mike Fader back again with Occupied Territory. I want to remind everybody, too, to please go to our Facebook page. The way you find that out is by going to Occupied Territory. Go to PRN, PRN FM. PRN, is it .FM? I always get this wrong. Rescue me here. PRN.FM and online. Go to the site there where the radio station is, go to Occupied Territory, the archives, and then you will find the Facebook page. I would love to get comments and questions on the Facebook page, posts of videos. I had interviewed a couple of times on this station and another station somebody named Jeannie Hartley, who was a member of Occupied Denver, and she sent me an email after a horrific police attack on the encampment there that involved riding motorcycles into people by the police, people shooting pepper ball bullets, wanton use of police sticks and tear gas, everything. And there was somebody who witnessed this and who's been covering the Occupy Denver movement since its inception. It's Chris Steele, who reports for an online newspaper, The Examiner, and he's based in Denver again. Hiya, Chris.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
Okay. Looking at your bio, it says here you're a musician as well as everything else. What's your musician status? What, you play an instrument, compose, what?
I play keyboard in a jazz group. I do vocals for a hip-hop group where I've actually toured the world doing that. So that's my main thing.
Okay. And so you work for The Examiner. It's an online newspaper, right?
Yes, it is.
And you were there on the night of November 12th into the early hours of the 13th, and the police charged the encampment and evicted everybody and broke it up and then committed tremendous acts of violence. I mean, can you tell me what you saw?
Yes. Well, when the movement first started, like I said, it was really nonviolent. The police were on board. And then just a couple weeks later, it got to be extremely violent, to where the police, they had their typical move back chant that they do, and some of the police were actually very vulgar about it, like, we're going to come here and kick you, and a lot of vulgarity in that. Mm-hmm. And that's when a guy climbed into the tree that day, and he was told to get down, and that's when all the police marched in, and this was still when it was light outside,
mm-hmm.
around 4 p.m., and they shot him directly with a tear gas canister and knocked him out of the tree, and then everyone around there started to run away, and then he was, on top of that, he was shot with rubber bullets. And that was just the beginning of the raid.
And there was, and then there were people who were smacked repeatedly for no good reason. People, like, you know, they were running after people and hitting them with batons, right?
Yeah, they were chasing them three blocks away in the 16th Street Mall, which is our big theater district, and that was actually shut down due to safety reasons. And there was, like, brinks of almost, like, wolf brigade of police just in different sections, just tracking down people with signs. And that's where I saw the man get hit by a motorcycle cop,
mm-hmm.
on the motorcycle, and he was arrested for assault on a police officer once he got out of the hospital.
Yeah, he was the one who was knocked unconscious, and I know the Colorado street medics tried to treat him, but the cops wouldn't let them anywhere near them, right?
Yes.
So,
and the main thing that happened that day, on top of all the violence towards adults, was a couple families were maced, and children were maced and pepper sprayed. There's been two children who were with mothers that were maced.
Why? And where were they? Where were they?
They were standing there observing. They were by the kitchen. I've noticed that these police across all the occupiers, they really hate these thoughts of these people's kitchens. They say they're unsanitary. I don't understand why they're such a target to be destroyed. But the children were by these kitchens where they give out free food donated. We have a couple pizza joints that donate the food.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids were maced. And I think that day that kid had to be hospitalized. And we just had a march for the children last weekend.
Well, what is the attitude or the reaction of people in Denver towards this kind of behavior?
Oh, people are actually, they're very outraged, the people who know about it. I guess we were just rated number one angriest city in America.
Angry?
Most protesters per capita.
Well, but I mean, usually, I looked at some of the other things. I checked this out, and I look at the local news channel. I look at the Denver Post? You get the usual, you know, the criminals, the dirty hippies, glad we got rid of them, and all that kind of, like, incredible, bigoted, stupid coverage. But, I mean, do you have some sense that the larger community in Denver is unhappy, at least, or outraged about what the cops did?
Definitely. They are enraged about that. But like you said, with the mass media, it's so hard to break through that barrier. Like my first article was about provocateurs that are supported by the mass media.
Mm-hmm.
When actually I had the chance to get in touch with Noam Chomsky about that issue. And he said it's definitely likely, and he thinks it's going on right now. And that's all you see. You see reports here about how there's the Occupy camps are filled with drug dealers and the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
You don't hear anything about the university professors who are there. We have a representative, McKinley, who goes down there regularly. You don't hear any of these reports. You're just hearing about the natives.
Oh, really? There's a city council member or a congressperson?
Yeah. Yeah, he's a representative of Denver, and his name is McKinley. He's an old cowboy-looking gentleman, and he's down there regularly, and I've never seen that mentioned in any news reports here.
Well, no, it's astounding. I mean, well, what do you expect when the people who are being protested against are the ones who actually own the TV stations and newspapers? I mean, you're in a bad spot there, right?
Yeah, definitely. And that's what I brought up in my provocateurs article about how all these news stations out here are primarily owned by Clear Channel, News Corp, AOL, Time Warner, and they're the ones that are essentially not even supporting any truth from this movement or any neutrality at that point.
Well, so what's going to happen with the movement now?
Well, we just had this really positive movement where the kids led the march. It was about 2,000 people this Saturday.
Really?
And, yeah, it was beautiful, and the kids spoke at the Capitol. Kids were speaking about their future. Kids were talking about how, well, I used to like police officers, but then one of them maced me and my mother. Do the police not like us? Like, genuine questions brought up amidst state troopers. And then a lot of kids just led some songs, and it was a positive event. There was no tear gas or anything that day.
But I guess they won't permit people to. Is it called a Civic Center Park or?
Yeah, it started in Lincoln Park, which was a state park, and Mayor Hickenlooper closed that park indefinitely.
So
they moved across the street to Civic Center.
So, but are they permitting? Are they going to permit anybody to actually camp out?
They're letting them camp out, but only on the sidewalk.
Oh.
And now there's no more tents, and there can be no more kitchen either, or place to set food.
Well, so we only have like a minute or two before I've got to move on and wrap the show up here. What, by the way, if you tuned in just now, you're listening to Chris Steele, S-T-E-E-L-E, and he's a reporter for The Examiner, an online newspaper, and he's based in Denver. Where do you figure that there's been a lot of evictions all over the country? What do you figure the Occupy movement does now? Winter's coming, they're being evicted. I mean, what's the next step?
Well, I think they just need to really solidify like what the Constitution has to do with protests, our tense free speech, and really get some guidelines laid out so we can start moving to bigger issues rather than protecting occupiers. Actually let them speak and have a dialogue between our country, our representatives, and get these general assemblies and Congress and legislature.
All right. So if you want to check out what is happening in Denver, it's like happening all over the place. But in Denver, if you're out there or if you want to look online, it's called what? Examiner or The Examiner online?
The Examiner.
Okay.
And then you can just type in Chris Steele or Occupy Wall Street. There's tons of tags up.
Okay. So we'll keep in touch.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for being on. And I'll get in touch with you again by email. Okay, Mike Fader here. This is Occupied Territory. Things are changing. There's been a lot of evictions, as we mentioned before. There are laws passed now. There were laws before, but now new laws are being passed. No tents, no encampments. Winter is coming. You can't have this movement run out of an office. You can't have this movement run out of a house somewhere or out of a building somewhere, because the visibility of the fact, the reason people are occupying this space, and it is illegal, it's trespass. There are nuisance laws, there are sanitation laws. These are minor local ordinances. Mostly, these are ticketing offenses. These people are out there, and they are out there for us, for all the rest of us. So we are all out there. Their bodies are on the line. I'm just talking on the radio. But they're putting their bodies on the line. It doesn't matter as far as I'm concerned, that they're breaking local ordinances. Yes, it's a nuisance for the people who live around there, but not such a terrible nuisance. And yes, they are marching without a permit, and they are holding up traffic in some places. And yes, a few local businesses are suffering. That's bad. That's not good, because a lot of these people are just part of the 99% themselves. But there, this is a democracy. This is a large country. There is no permanent state for anything. You don't stay in a permanent state. Your body doesn't, the weather doesn't, nothing stays permanent. There is no permanent America. It always has to be renewed. And that's what's happening now. For the last 40 years, America has been in a kind of a coma. We've been entertained to death. We've listened to campaign speeches. We've bought their bullshit for years now. We buy every new piece of shiny crap that they sell us. It's time for everybody to wake up. That's what these people are doing there. If their right to free speech and their right to assembly, for which hundreds of thousands of Americans died in wars and were permanently disabled, maybe a million or more, if those rights are not guaranteed by those deaths and those sacrifices, then local ordinances, then we are not a country anymore. We're not a democracy anymore. We are fast slipping into a police state. So my point of view is, yes, they are breaking local laws, but they're breaking it for a much larger, more important cause, which is for all of us. That's the way I see it. So once again, I want to mention, as I usually do at the close of the show, that if you want to get more information, by the way, I also have a show on PRN called The Turning Point. I'm on Thursdays at 1 o'clock, so I'll be on tomorrow at 1 o'clock. And this is where I interview people about other subjects, or I just talk about things, essays about cultural events, personal stories. So that's tomorrow at 1 o'clock on Thursdays. If you want to check and see what's happening on a regular basis with the Occupy movement, go to alternet.org. And you can also check Common Dreams. Common Dreams is a good place to go. And once again, please check out our Facebook page. Go to Occupied Territory, the archives on PRN here. And we have to take this country back now. We can't wait till the spring. We can't operate out of an office. Now, I'm saying we. People are out there in the cold. People are out there being beat up by the cops. I'm on the radio. I'm doing what I can do. We all need to do what we can do. We have to support these people. We have to see that their rights aren't violated. We have to see that they aren't beaten up. And these are our children. These are people on college campuses. Anybody out there listening has kids who are college age, teenagers? They were spraying and breaking their ribs and fracturing their skulls. Cops on campuses. They were nonviolent. These people are 99%, to use a certain term, nonviolent people. We cannot let this happen. They are debating a bill in the Senate today as we're speaking that if the president signed it, if it was passed and the president signed it, would allow the military to come into this country and arrest Americans. The military could do the same thing in this country against whoever they call a terrorist. That could be you or me or anybody on the street. And they could just lock them up the same way as they did in Guantanamo. No rights, nothing. We are at the very edge and falling off. We're holding on by our fingernails on the edge of a cliff of democracy, about to fall into a police state. So, last quote here for today. I usually wind up with a quote. Adolf Hitler was once quoted by his aide, Joachim Fest, as saying, "What good fortune for those in power that people do not think." That's from Adolf Hitler. And from Thomas Paine, "But such is the irresistible nature of truth that all it asks and all it wants is the liberty of appearing." Of appearing. People need to be out there, and we need to support them.